Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Måske så har du aldrig rigtig tænkt over det, men du er altså bare en kødsæk fuld af data. Data, som man kan analysere på alle mulige leder og kanter. Og resultatet af den her analyse, ja, den kan bruges af virksomheder, offentlige myndigheder, spiontjenester eller hackere til at sælge dig ting, overvåge dig, manipulere dig politisk, eller måske hjælpe dig med at holde lidt styr på dine motioner og dit helbred. Den amerikanske whistleblower Edward Snowden, han udtrykte det for nylig på den her måde på festivalen Web Summit i Lissabon.
You use these services and they create a permanent record of everything you've done simply by having your phone in this room on you in your pocket, not even using it, but simply having it turned on. Registers your presence at this event because your phone's association with the Wi-Fi points that are around it, your phone's association with the cellular towers that are around it. And this is the thing that, people miss. All of these companies, all of these governments go, oh, data collection, data protection. I mean, it's all very abstract. But data isn't harmless. Data isn't abstract. When it's about people. And almost all of the data that's being collected today is about people. It is not data that is being exploited. It is people that are being exploited. It is not data and networks that are being influenced and manipulated. It is you that is being manipulated. And right now, the reason that is so, and the reason surveillance and collection is so much of a problem, is because we have to trust everybody on the network. We have to trust everyone that we pass on this hostile path of the internet. All of the routers, all of the internet service providers that you cross. If you have to trust Cisco or Juniper or Huawei or Nokia, we have a problem because you can't trust any of them. They will all act in their own interest rather than the public's interest broadly, whether it's a private company or a national telecommunications company. It is an institution of power. And our communications are vulnerable today to every single one of them until we change the model, until we redesign the basic system of connectivity in the internet.
Som du kan høre, så er Edward Snowden mere end bekymret for det datasamfund, vi alle sammen lever i lige nu. Og hvis du aldrig har tænkt over det, så har du faktisk et problem, fordi så har du formodentlig ikke forstået det datasamfund, vi lever i. Men bare rolig, Tektopia er her i din øresnegl for at hjælpe dig. I den her podcast, der kan du møde Asa Raskin fra Center for Humane Technology i Californien, der har sat sig for, at teknologi skal være for mennesker og ikke omvendt. Og Asa Raskin, han har en lang teknologikarriere bag sig, så nu vil han reformere branchen til det bedre. I næste udgave af Tektopia, der kommer du til at møde Carly Kent fra Ada Lovelace Institute i London, som er en tænketank, der kigger på nogle af de samme ting, som Asa Raskin gør. Og så skal vi også høre om Googles nye principper for ansvarlig kunstig intelligens. Men i dag der skal vi altså hilse på Asa Raskin fra Center for Humane Technology, som jeg mødte på årets Tech Festival.
My name is Asa Raskin. I'm one of the co-founders for the Center for Humane Technology. And we work on addressing the way that technology now is systematically destabilizing and tearing apart our societies, and looking forward to a future of humane technology which respects the limits of us as human beings and realigns technology with our and our society's best interests.
So now you define the problem that you're trying to find a solution for. Could you define or give me some examples of the problems that you see?
A sadly long list. Let's just take a look at YouTube. It turns out, right, 70% of all watches on YouTube come from algorithmic recommendations. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But what's getting recommended? Well, because the companies, Facebook, Google, all the major ones, make their money based on grabbing our attention, it means that the things that the recommendation engines show us are things that are hacking sort of like our fundamental human nature. They're not things we want to look at. They're things we can't help but look at. And so, you know, in April of this year, researcher Guillaume Chazelot looked at what are the top recommendations, what words get recommended most by that algorithm. And the words like, here are the top 10 lists, slams, obliterates, demolishes, these are shreds. These are sort of like angry words because they grab our attention. And we're dosing ourselves a billion hours a day with these kinds of messages. And so, you know, the what's another good one? The number of search results that are for flat earth conspiracies on YouTube, 90% for the recommendations, because it turns out conspiracy theories are really good at grabbing our attention. And when you start thinking about the systematic effects that fracking us for our attention has, well, right, if our attention span starts to shrink, right, and Gloria Marks' research shows that we now self-interrupt every 40 seconds, not our natural state for humans, that's our minds having been fattened for the extraction of attention. If attention span shrinks, that means the nuance in the messages that we send back and forth shrink, which means that polarization has to go up because you're having to say and shout louder to be heard. And if polarization is going up, that means us versus them thinking is going up, which is the right conditions for social isolation, it's the right conditions for fascism, it's the right conditions for populism. And so you see this whole interconnected set of harms that comes from companies being hell-bent on extracting our attention.
And this is because of the business model, the freemium business model?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This the hyper-growth freemium business model, where it feels like it's we're getting things for free, but actually the true cost is everything.
And you're talking about well-being being downgraded. Could you explain that term?
Yeah. I mean, I think we all feel that it's like our relationships are starting to like degrade. We have more of them, but each one means a little less. We've seen a huge spike at the rise of social media. So high depressive symptoms and suicidal thoughts for in especially young women was sort of holding steady and declining a little bit from the 80s through the 90s. And around 2013, it goes from being, you know, around 17-18% to spikes by 2017 to 29%, right? And why would this be? Well, what happens, right? It's not just enough to get your attention, right? If I send you lots of notification, eventually you can turn it off. But if I can instead get you addicted to needing attention, well, that would be way more efficient. So how might I do that? How about if I showed you proof every single day that people liked you more if only you looked different than you actually did, right? And that's how we end up with, in 2017, over 50%, 55% of plastic surgeons in the U.S. report having seen a patient that's asking to look like their Snapchat or Instagram filter, right? Or how about if we showed you proof every single day that people liked you more if only you were living a life that isn't actually yours? Well, that's social media, right? Not only do we get the comparison sadness looking at everyone else, but we then feel it inside of ourselves. And that's how we get that depressive spike. And so you combine all of these things, and you're like, oh yeah, technology is downgrading our mental health, our children's mental health, our ability to have conversation, and hence have a functioning democracy. It's driving us towards societal incoherence exactly at the moment that we are faced with huge, you know, perhaps existential, but certainly catastrophic problems like climate change, when we need to be working in tandem, making the most sense and making the best decisions. Technology is instead driving us apart.
But then you have a center for humane technology, so you're not a Luddite. I mean, we should still use technology, but how should we use it?
Yeah. Well, so it's exactly right. This is not a anti-technology kind of message. It's instead asking the fundamental question, like, wait, what is technology even for? Right? Technology is for taking the parts of us which are human, that are most brilliant about us, and extending them. That's what a cello is. That's what a paintbrush is. That's what language is. That's what technology could be. It's sort of a return to that Doug Engelbart sort of idea of what technology is that it's supposed to enhance our collective intelligence. And really, that's it. We're saying technology shouldn't downgrade us. Technology needs to embrace our Paleolithic emotions, our Paleolithic brains and instincts, understand that we as human beings have limits, have properties. In when designing for hardware, we have a field called ergonomics, right? Which is the study of like how our bodies bend and fold so we can design for them. There's the study of cognetics, which is how our minds bend and fold. There isn't yet a name for the study of how our societies bend and fold as a kind of ergonomics, or our communities bend and fold, or our relationships bend and fold. But what we're working with at the Center for Humane Technology is the idea that technology, if it's aware of how we bend and fold, can help augment all the things we want. Technology could help us make decisions we love and spend time the way that we look back and feel was best.
And how do we do that?
One way to think about it is to move from having attention interfaces, which are grabbing attention, moving to intention-based interfaces. So instead of measuring time on screen, figure out new metrics that your users actually care about. So for instance, like net promoter score type of things. So here's an example of a much better interface. Right now, if we want to hang out, right? The way we do that is we have to open up our phones. Immediately, there's an N number of distractions. We have to open up an app. Let's say we're talking with Facebook, and it shows us a feed of stuff that distracts us from the original intent. Much better if I could just say, hey, phone, Siri, Henrik, you and I, like, let's have a couple dinners this year. Like, let's have 4 or 5 dinners. And behind the scenes, our phones should already know our calendars. They can talk in a privacy-preserving way. And bing, 2 days later, we can have 4 dinners scheduled. That would be a much better interface for us spending time, because our relationships don't have an interface on our phone. There's no place to be like, I want to strengthen this relationship. There's just a QWERTY keyboard that asks me what to do. It can be really simple things like, in order to fight social isolation and loneliness, we should definitely be having easier ways of having people come together. Throwing a dinner, like when I think about it, it's always a little scary because what happens if nobody shows up, right? So there's a great technology for that. It's called a co-host. You have 2 people host a dinner. You could imagine that Facebook has that sort of built into the interface. So you set it up. You're like, oh, you know, you're looking at your calendar. I have an empty spot. I want to set up a dinner. It immediately asks me who my co-host is. I center it in. And now all of a sudden, like all of the social anxiety starts to atrophy away. So it's fundamentally looking in a mirror at us as people and designing for the way that we work from the emotional level to the intention and cognition level, to how we make sense of the world, how we make decisions, how we do social reasoning and group reasoning, and our social environment, and understanding that full stack as we design.
But you pointed at the freemium business model as being a problem here. So how would you build this? I mean, how would you finance it, and what kind of technology would you use, and how would you scale it?
Yeah, so I think Apple can have a huge role, or Samsung, these other companies, because they're sort of the city designers, if you will, of our attention ecology. So they could create a kind of race to the top based on experiences that people actually really want. So imagine instead of find my friends on my phone, it was time with friends. You expressed an intention of whatever you want, dinners, more hangouts, video games with friends, whatever it is. And after you say, this is what I want, Apple could then turn around to all of these different service providers, Yelp and Facebook, Google, and they could all be competing to get us to spend time together or to have more dinners. The other way to think about it is there's this glass ceiling of business model. So even when you design something brilliant, it might, you have to break through the business model glass ceiling, and you have to, I think, break that from the top. So one of the ideas we're really interested in exploring now is the idea of a fiduciary. There are two types of, and this is at the policy level, there are two types of relationships in law. There is the relationships between equals, and these are leases and NDAs, and we can sit and sign whatever we want. And then there's relationships between parties that have, where one has an asymmetric power over the other. These are doctors and lawyers and therapists. With a doctor, you have to tell them your weaknesses in order for them to heal you. Therapists are not allowed to sleep with their clients. It's illegal because obviously what you tell your therapist opens you up for deep exploitation. So these people, doctors, lawyers, priests who take confessions, have to act in the best interests of their clients. Otherwise, huge damages are sort of brought against them. Companies have been masquerading as contractual relationships. Why we all click through the EULAs, but no one actually reads them or even understands what they mean. When they're really a fiduciary, they know more about us strictly than our doctors and our lawyers and our therapists. And once you make that simple change of realizing, oh, that's right, these technology companies have a fiduciary relationship with us, that means the freemium business model, the ad-based business model, doesn't really work anymore. And so that's the kind of change I think we need at a policy level, a government level, where it creates the conditions in which the right kind of technology companies can grow.
On your website and in your talks, you also mentioned the relationship with the artificial intelligence, that we're sort of being the resource of training an artificial intelligence. How do you think about flipping this relationship to turn it into us being sort of the ones who use the AI for what you're just describing, and not the AI using us to tap a lot of data on us?
There's the other thing we think about all the time is, futurists have this fixation on the singularity, right? This is the point when technology surpasses the things that we humans are best at, and hence lose control forever. But there's a point that happens much earlier. What we've all missed is the place where technology starts to surpass human weakness happens much, much sooner. And in fact, our feeling of information overload, those sort of like the Marshall Islands going undersea because of climate change. But it's, after that, like tech addiction. Like we are all now glued to our phones because they're overwhelming our internal self-regulation systems, right? Like, are we oppressed by our digital servants? How else would you get all of humanity to like bow their heads and then stroke their masters? Once you see that there's, before like the singularity, there's a point much earlier, the human limit singularity, and that we're approaching really fast, that gives you, I think, the insight of, okay, we have to stop believing that humans and our attention and our cognition is an infinite resource, and instead it's the most precious finite resource, and we should be doing everything we can to protect it. So in that frame, what we task AI with would be very different, right? The fundamental lesson of the paperclip maximizer, right? Like where you tell an AI to go make paperclips, and it does everything. And soon it's tearing apart the world and the universe to make paperclips, is you have to be very careful what you wish for, because it will come true in unintended ways. Fundamentally, what we're saying is that what we wish for is to grab human attention, and it's coming true, and it's coming true in unintended ways. So it's not about stopping and saying, let's not continue work on AI, but it's saying the thing we always feared is coming true right now. And when people always thought about the paperclip maximizer, they're like, oh, but it doesn't matter, we'll turn it off. Like, if it looks like it's getting out of control, we'll turn it off. When you talk to the engineers at YouTube about why their recommendation engines are recommending extremism and conspiracies, thinspiration, they'll be like, well, we're not really quite sure. You're like, this is it. This is the moment we've all been fearing. And we can't turn it off because it's hooked up to a business model.
So what you're saying is that we have already reached the point of the singularity of human weakness when it comes to artificial intelligence.
I think we're right at that point, you know, and it's unclear whether it happens like now, or is it 1 year from now, or was it 6 months ago, but it's within this period of time. And the question is, can we collectively wake up for long enough to see the direction that we are going and decide to stop and go a different direction? Like, we have, I think, that moment now when we're like, we can like gasp out for breath before we're completely submerged.
And who should lead this sort of revolution?
Well, you know, in some ways you can think of, you know, the problem of downgrading humanity. It's sort of like it's like a climate change of culture. But what's different about it is that, unlike climate change, only a small, relatively group of people need to change what they're doing in making products to have huge impact. You know, 1,000, 10,000 people. It's us as technology makers that could decide to make something different tomorrow and fix it. So it's not about who is going to lead. This is a question each and every one of us as technologists needs to face so that we can make the right decisions.
Og det var altså Asa Raskin fra Center for Humane Technology. Jeg skal nævne, at han også har en podcast sammen med kollegaen Tristan Harris. Den hedder Your Undivided Attention, og den stiller også skarpt på de problemer, der opstår, når vi alle sammen bor i et datasamfund, som er domineret af nogle enkelte tech-giganter. Der er meget mere Techtopia om datasamfundet i Techtopia Radio 4, som netop er kommet ud på podcast. Techtopia handler i dag om datasamfundet og hvad der sker med alle de data, som vi producerer her i informationssamfundet døgnet rundt. Jeg har to gæster i studiet, som begge to har skrevet kloge bøger her på det seneste om netop data og den måde, som det nye informationssamfund det virker og fungerer på. Rikke Frank Jørgensen, du er seniorforsker på Institut for Menneskerettigheder, og du har en bog med.
Den er på engelsk. Den hedder Human Rights in the Age of Platforms, og på dansk vil man sige menneskerettigheder i en platformtid. Jeg har meget et rettighedstake på det, vi skal snakke om i dag. Altså, hvad betyder det for den enkeltes friheder og rettigheder?
Mikkel Flyverbom, du sidder ved siden af. Du er professor i kommunikation og digital transformation på CBS Copenhagen Business School.
Jeg har skrevet en bog, der hedder The Digital Prism, Transparency and Managed Visibilities in a Datafied World. Og den kigger på, hvad der sker, når digital teknologi bliver sådan en form for prisme, som vores liv ligesom bliver reflekteret igennem, og som skaber nogle nye vilkår for at leve i det her samfund.
Så en anden måde at anskue informationssamfundet på?
Ja, og et forsøg på at ligesom udfordre den her idé om, at digital teknologi er bare sådan nogle neutrale vinduer, vi kan åbne på en virkelighed, og så ser vi, hvordan den virkelig ser ud. Jeg tror, der er nogle meget mere komplekse brydninger i gang, som handler om, at vores liv tager nye former og bliver At mennesker, når vi ser dem gennem data eller som data, så kommer mennesker til at fremstå på særlige måder, som vi bliver nødt til at tale om.
Og så har du øvrigt også bidraget med et kapitel til Rikkes bog, så vidt jeg
har
forstået.
Det har jeg. Det er faktisk et kapitel, der kigger på, hvordan, hvad det er for nogle nye informationsstrømme, der opstår på grund af digitalisering og datificering. Så hvordan er det, vi som individer får adgang til særlige former for viden, som ikke nødvendigvis tager traditionelle former, men også kan være noget, der er skabt af robotter og algoritmer og digitale systemer osv.
Og du kan finde podcast med de to danske forskere via tektopia.dk. Som sagt, så kigger jeg i næste uge mere på datasamfundet, hvor vi skal hilse på Carly Kent fra Ada Lovelace Institute i London, som er en tænketank, der kigger kritisk på brugen af data og kunstig intelligens. Og så skal vi hilse på Olivier Bousquet fra Google for deres afdeling for kunstig intelligens i Zürich, hvor han har været med til at lave Googles nye principper for ansvarlig kunstig intelligens. Men det er altså en næste udgave af Tektopia. Her der skal vi have podkort fra Ingeniørens podcast Transformator.
Danmark importerer enorme mængder træ fra udlandet, som vi brænder af i varmeværkerne, fordi vi har bildt hinanden ind, at det er en CO2-neutral energiform. Men tallene passer slet ikke. Og nu bruger vi flere penge på at støtte en forurenende energiform, end vi bruger i støtte til sol og vind tilsammen. Ej, men så har vi da vindmøllerne. Ja, heller ikke her har vi helt styr på energien. Det viser sig nemlig, at danske vindmøller stadig oftere bliver nødt til at stå helt stille, selvom det blæser. Hør den paradoksale forklaring på de her paradokser i denne uges Transformator fra Teknologiens Mediehus.
Når jeg ikke lige ved, hvad jeg skal lave, så laver jeg hjemmelavet teknomusik. Og for nylig så gik det ud over det her interview med Edward Snowden fra Web Summit. Så her der kommer et stykke hjemmelavet techno, der handler om data og datasamfundet. Du kan finde links og podcastarkiv på tektopia.dk. Du kan skrive til mig på henrik@tektopia.dk. Du kan følge med på Twitter på @tektopia.dk. Og så kan du deltage i debatten i vores Facebook-gruppe Tektopia Backstage. På genhør.
It is you that is being manipulated.
Tektopia.